KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers. Experience the new 2024 Tacoma at your local dealer and learn about the new lineup, including turbocharged four-cylinder engines and a hybrid powertrain option. San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. Comic-Con is underway, so for today's show, we'll take you inside preview night. I'm Jade Hindman. Here's to conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. KPBS film critic and Comic-Con expert Beth Accomando tells us what keeps her coming back to the convention.
Pop culture is something everybody partakes in all the time, whether they know it or not. If you watch a movie, if you watch a TV show, if you do anything that involves the popular arts, you are a part of this in some way, shape, or form.
Then a panel on the mainstream emergence of Afrofuturism, plus the career of animator Bobby Rubio. That's ahead on Midday Edition. San Diego Comic-Con is back in full swing. Last year's pop culture convention saw a diminished Hollywood presence due to writers and actor strikes. But now the studios and stars are back. But as longtime attendees know, the convention has so much to offer for pop culture fans of all kinds. On today's Comic-Con edition of Midday, we are previewing some of the festivities, also highlighting the creators and artists who are advocating for representation in their fields. We'll talk about Afrofuturism and representation in animation. But first, we actually went on site last night at the San Diego Convention Center and checked in with KPBS's Beth Accomando. Here's that conversation. So, Beth, we're here on the exhibit floor. There are a lot of tables, a lot of all kinds of things set up. What am I seeing? What am I looking at here? Describe the scene for me.
Well, you are on the exhibit floor. It is a quarter mile long. So, you know, if you have to traverse this a lot, you're putting in a lot of miles. And there's everything down here. There's some movie studios, there's collectibles, there's comics. You know, it all depends what you're interested in, but you could pretty much find it here.
Wow. Well, we're sitting in your booth. So how does it feel to come back each year?
It's always exhausting and I'm never ready, but it's something I absolutely adore despite the exhaustion. It's a great place to be. I'm a pop culture person. I love the fact that I can walk around here and say something like, no matter where you go, and somebody else will finish it and say, there you are, and I know they love Buckaroo Banzai, and I can't do that anywhere else.
Well, it's a labor of love for sure. Well, okay, so let me ask you this, because last year's Comic-Con looked a lot different, right? It was a little thin. You had the actors and screenwriters on strike. Now it seems like things are really kind of back in full swing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's funny because as somebody who loved the convention before it got big, last year was great. Like, it was, you could move around more. All the vendors were having more sales. They had like their best year ever for a lot of people. I did not miss Hollywood. I love the fact that they are coming back, but you know, to me, Comic-Con is so many things. It can be whatever you want to make it, and there's always something to find. So, you know, this idea of, oh, it's back to normal now. You know, last year was a great year for me. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the focus was really on comics. Which is kind of the heartbeat of what Comic-Con is.
Yes.
So how would you describe the landscape for comics at this convention this year?
Well, it does change. You know, you're not going to find as many of the vintage comic book dealers as you used to. There's some big distributors that are no longer here. But you know what? There are still comics here, and there's a lot of comic publishers here, a lot of indie comic publishers, a lot of artists. There's also web comic people. So you can find so much stuff here if you look for it. And the panels also will highlight not only the big comics, but also things that I love are the little nerdy stuff about inking or lettering or coloring, stuff that I don't know anything about. And to be able to go to a panel and learn more more about what that is makes me appreciate the craft of creating a comic even more.
Well, I mean, also, there's a lot of film stuff. You are KPBS's film critic, so anything we should be looking out for on that front? What are you excited about?
Well, actually, the thing I'm most excited about is not film, but TV. I love what we do in the shadows, and Matt Berry is one of my favorite people, and he's going to be here for a panel in Hall H, so I am looking forward to that.
Ah, very nice. All right. Well, are you on a panel this year? I mean, tell us about that.
Yes, so I was actually writing for Giant Robot Magazine, which is a magazine about Asian pop culture. It's a fabulous magazine that used to be printed like in the garage of the two publishers. I was doing some interviews with Hong Kong celebrities like Chow Yun-fat and Sammo Hung and people like that. And so there are some people on the panel to talk about the old days and where Giant Robot is going. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, wow. And listen to that. Someone just turned on a display. I can hear the movies running in the background. There's just so much to take in here at Comic-Con. 600 hours of programming. What's on your highlight reel for today?
Well, today is preview night, so there's not a whole lot to do. But I will say that one of the best-kept secrets here is the Comic-Con International Independent Film Festival. And that has films running every day. And that's a great thing to check out. If you love artists, Quick Draw is one of the funniest panels you will go to. It's three artists improvising cartoons right in front of you on a big screen, and that's always fabulous. So there really is so much to choose from.
Yeah.
So it's hard to like give advice because everybody's interests are different.
You just have to like pace yourself. I mean, there's so much to take in. And you've been doing this since the 70s.
Yes.
So do you have any like really fond Comic-Con memories?
Yes. So back in the old days when the panelists would walk right out into the lobby after a panel, Guillermo del Toro came out and I had a chance to chat with him. And all these young filmmakers were giving him DVDs. And when he went to leave, he turned to his assistant and he said, "Where are my treasures?" Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the DVDs that these people had given him, and he actually watches them. I've heard from filmmakers. It may take like 2 or 3 years, but he actually like cares enough to do that. So I love that, and I think it reflects really the best of Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah. The opportunity to really get to meet with folks and see the creators who create all of this. You know, there's a lot of off-site stuff happening too, Beth. Anything catch your eye out there, or are you going to pretty much stay inside the convention?
I rarely get to leave the floor, but I will say, as a fan of Shaun of the Dead, it's the 20th anniversary. They're going to kind of redo the Winchester Bar or pub, and I am going to make an effort to go see what that's all about, and I even brought my cricket bat.
Okay, well, we'll wait. We'll see. We'll see what happens with that. I feel like the energy Comic-Con brings to San Diego each year is really, like, palpable, even for non-pop culture fans. It's like the whole city really comes together to celebrate.
Well, pop culture is something everybody partakes in all the time, whether they know it or not. If you watch a movie, if you watch a TV show, if you, you know, do anything that involves the popular arts, you are a part of this in some way, shape, or form. So I think it's something everybody can identify with, and it's very accessible in terms of, you know, the stuff that it's highlighting. You can buy a comic anywhere. You can go see a movie anywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people love this stuff.
We also spoke to some attendees about what they're looking forward to most and what Comic-Con means to them. Tony Yao has been coming to the convention for over 30 years. He said everyone has their own reason for being there.
You know, some people do cosplay, some people collect toys, comics, whatever it is. I mean, I'm a toy person. That's what I do. But a lot of people are here for the other things, cards, promo stuff, freebies, panels. So there's something here for everybody.
Well, there definitely is still to come. While there's something for everyone, there's also representation for everyone.
We get to unerase ourselves and actually, like, basically say, you know what? This particular medium can actually represent everyone.
Hear more about Afrofuturism and its growing popularity when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back. This is KPBS Midday Edition. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Marvel Studios is back at Comic-Con this year, and as always, there's major hype around their Hall H panels. That's where they welcome the cast of the 2018 Black Panther movie and its 2022 sequel before they even hit theaters.
My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be. Don't freeze.
I never freeze.
Beyond being a massive success, the Black Panther universe brought Afrofuturism to the cinematic mainstream, and the movement continues to have a presence at the convention. I spoke with three Afrofuturists about how the movement influences comics and pop culture as a whole. Best-selling author and artist John Jennings joined the conversation. He's a Hugo and Eisner Award winner and a professor at UC Riverside. Also, comic book artist Keithan Jones, founder of Kid Comics, which is a San Diego-based independent comic book publisher, and Luana Richmond, executive director and founder of Grioneers. She also runs the Afrofuturism Lounge, which takes place during Comic-Con each year. Take a listen. For listeners who might be unfamiliar with what Afrofuturism is, what is it?
Wow, Afrofuturism has a lot of different definitions. It can be as narrowly defined as art, literature, music that positions African Americans in the center as opposed to on the margins or just plain absent in like some of the early sci-fi. Or it could be expanded into critical thought and social justice and thinking about Black people throughout the diaspora thriving. It's a connection between the past, the present, and the future. So some people use Sankofa as a thread connecting it. And for me, I use it to also get people to envision desired outcomes and reverse engineer their way to making those outcomes reality.
Hmm. We mentioned Black Panther earlier, but there are so many important figures who were at the forefront of the movement. Who are some of those leaders?
So Octavia Butler gets credited with being the mother of Afrofuturism, but there have been Black science fiction and fantasy writing since like the early 20th century. There was a science fiction story uncovered that was written by W.E.B. Du Bois. Some people credit a lot of make a connection between Dogon theory and Afrofuturism. And then now I would say I look at Tanana Reeve Du, Stephen Barnes, of course, John Jennings, and Rinaldo Anderson as people that are kind of on the forefront these days.
John, you're a longtime Afrofuturist and have dedicated much of your career to the movement. Where were you first exposed to it?
The first time I came across the term, I was actually working on a collection of these Black cyborg images, and for the audience, that's cybernetic organisms. So if you've ever seen like the Terminator or things like that nature, it's like a creature that's made from like metal or like technology and flesh, that kind of thing. It's a cyberpunk reference from science fiction. So I was doing like a bunch of those, just kind of referencing stereotypes, Black stereotypes, and how they kind of keep popping up in media, you know, that kind of thing. And one of my friends who was an Africanist, her name was Dana Rush. I was working at the University of Illinois at the time. This is like early 2000s, like 2007, something like that. And she said, oh, I love these. These look really Afrofuturist. And I'm like, I don't know what that is, you know? And so I started doing, research. And it turns out that, yeah, you know, the term gets coined by Mark Derry in like 93. And I started doing research and went down to, you know, started doing digging around, and I realized like, yeah, this is a cultural movement that kind of uses the frame of science fiction and fantasy in that kind of Afrocentric, you know, kind of epistemology or mindset. So since then, I became like obsessed with it. And now I teach like 3 on the books classes on Afrofuturism in different venues at the University of California, Riverside now.
Wow. And Keith, and what about you? What was your first introduction to Afrofuturism?
I wasn't really familiar with the term Afrofuturism, or even knew who John was or Luana, who they were, until I was approached by my mother, who worked with the Malcolm X Library here in San Diego, and they wanted to expand their Black History Month program by incorporating comics or art or something like that. So they approached me. I was about to turn it down, but I thought that, you know, I sat there and thought about it. I was like, might be a great opportunity to build a platform where Black creators can have a venue where they can display their work and have a voice that's not filtered or overshadowed by bigger entities, like at San Diego Comic Con, for instance. And so I created Black Comics Day, and I've been doing Black Comics Day every February for the last 7 years now. And through that process is when I started hearing the term Afrofuturism, Black speculative arts, and stuff like that. And so I just kind of fell into it in a natural way, and which is when I ran into Luana and John and so many other creators in this space.
Well, what makes comics, you think, and graphic novels even, a good medium to present Afrofuturist concepts and ideas? And let's throw in their movies and series as well.
Personally, I think that because you are utilizing symbolic means to communicate, and actually because comics rely on representation, that you can easily, like, you know, really kind of disrupt the erasure of Black images in comics. Because let's be real, like up until fairly recently, or like, you know, particularly like the 1960s, you really did not see Black superheroes at all, right? Mm-hmm. Until we get a character, say like Black Panther or what have you. But of course, there were Black characters in the cartoon, you know, the Black, Black press, the Black independent media, like, you know, the Chicago Defender and things like that. But I think one of the major things is the fact that we get to unerase ourselves and actually, like, basically say, you know what? This particular medium can actually represent everyone. And so it's a lot, it's very empowering for like Black creators to actually say that and actually like create and publish our works these days. I think it's that's part of it. Like really like looking at the past, but also, as Luana says, like using Sankofa to kind of push ourselves into the future.
Yeah, I also would like to add that you're asking what are the benefits of doing it through graphic novel media. It's affordable. On paper, you have an unlimited budget. Whatever you visualize in your head, you can put it out on paper. You don't need to go find super sponsors and raise all this money to make a film, for instance, or be flat out rejected because the studio doesn't believe in your project. So this medium lends itself to whatever you come up with, you know, creatively, and there's no real barriers there other than the cost of paper. It's more accessible is what I'm saying. And with the success of the Marvel films, for instance, it's become part of the zeitgeist as far as comic culture and how it's all tied into popular media now. So things just fell in place at the right time, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you're all very involved in Comic-Con and organize outside of it. What's the representation of Afrofuturism been like over the years, particularly in the realm of pop culture? Luana?
Ooh, I think there's been a lot of improvement. I think, you know, not to say that our event changed what Comic-Con did, but I did notice a lot more Black-centered or Afrofuturism panels and workshops after the first year. And, you know, I'm sure the success of the Black Panther film was a huge push for that. And so we see more of that, and we see less pushback of people trying to say what the race of an imaginary character should be when people cosplay. I didn't mention it before, but it's really cool for me to be with Keithan and John today because, you know, they were instrumental in helping me start the Afrofuturism Lounge.
Well, Keithan, what about you? You went to Comic-Con growing up and actually got your start there. What are you seeing now, and how have things changed?
I mean, Black creators have always been there. So it's not that we just appeared on the scene out of nowhere. So I guess, like Luana said, there's less static around it.
The friction is disappearing.
Yeah, it's a little more, it's noticeably more acceptable. People feel more comfortable on both sides. The fans are more comfortable to showing, professing their love for the stuff. And the creators are more relaxed about presenting their voices in a more true manner. As opposed to, it's crazy. When I was a kid, and this is, I actually thought about that stuff when I made my own characters. Like, I would literally think about, well, if I made the leader of the superhero team black, that people might not like it. And I'm thinking, as an older man now, I'm thinking like, how nuts and terrible it is for a child to have that kind of thought in their head, you know? And I'm talking about 11 years old, 11, 12 year old. Having dreams of being a comic book creator and doing all this fantastic stuff, but also having enough sense to know that if I made particular characters a certain ethnicity, I might get pushback. And it just illustrates how real and how oppressive that type of thinking can be for a child, even though people may not notice it on the surface, it's going on internally. And that's because when you're growing up, you're inundated with, have to call it like it is, you're inundated with white characters from birth, you know, being the protagonist or being the heroes, you know. So it's not something a child actively thinks about, but it's subconsciously baked in there. That's what I'm saying.
But you're immersed in a system, especially when you were a child, where most of the messages about leaders and heroes, fictional as well as historic, were the stories of white men.
Right. It's like what John was saying, the unerasing of history and our imagery, like, you know, because to this day we're still fighting the stereotypes. You still see films where the black characters are there for comic relief or doing something goofy.
Or the first to die.
First to die or non-consequential stuff, you know. And it goes beyond the African-American, I mean, you see it with Asian characters, you see it with Latino characters. For some reason, we're pigeonholed into these stereotypes. Now, it's a lot better now. It is a lot better now, and I don't want to say there hasn't been progress, because there has. And like I said, especially within the last 10 years, and we're finally climbing out of that. At least we're trending in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, even when you look at how just education around Black history, ethnic studies, all of that is being suppressed. It is sometimes that you turn to something, you know, whether it's a series or a movie or a comic book, and within the Afrofuturism genre, and learn something about African culture or something like that.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Keith and then Luana brought up some really great points. So what we're talking about really is like we've always suffered a certain level of narrative scarcity when it comes to Black images or images of marginalized people. And the other thing is that traditionally in media, you know, the idea of whiteness has colonized the idea of normality, right? Mm-hmm. Or like it's the default of, you know, the character, right? You just assume that person is going to be a white cishet male. And so that has definitely been something that on one hand has actually like created a certain level of empathy that Black people, I think, extend to different characters that has definitely had not been reciprocated until fairly recently. And I was thinking about this, too, as far as like how we're looking at Afrofuturism now. One of the most amazing things I think that's come out of this movement is that the major institutions in our country have now actually celebrated Afrofuturism as a legitimate like cultural movement. Currently, right now, there is an Afrofuturism show at the Smithsonian, at the National Museum of African-American History and Culture. Mm-hmm. It's been up for like a year. At the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, there is a permanent Afrofuturist period room that was designed by Hannah Beekler, who was the Oscar-winning set designer for Black Panther. It's called Before Yesterday, We Could Fly. There has been shows at, you know, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. There have been shows at various museums across the country, including just recently something at the Lincoln Center, actually, too, you know. There's these different like cultural movements. Carnegie Hall actually did an eight-week celebration of Afrofuturism that was curated by some of the top Afrofuturist scholars in the in the country. So it's become a mainstream conversation. As Keithan and Luana just said, you can actually walk into a boardroom now and say, oh, I have this action adventure story and it's Afrofuturist. And people know exactly what you're talking about. So you're like looking at a point where before Black Panther and after Black Panther. And I would actually also add Jordan Peele's Get Out to that conversation too.
Yeah. Well, John, you're also an editor. How are you bringing Afrofuturist stories to the market and really elevating those voices?
For the last 5 years, I've been curating a line of comic books, graphic novels with Abrams Comic Arts, the same publishers of Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And it's called Megascope. And it's actually named after a device that was in the story that Luana mentioned earlier, The Princess Steel, where the Du Bois comes up with a device that can see into different dimensions called a megascope. And so I thought it'd be a great name for a imprint. And so we actually have, for instance, Afrofuturist work from Barbados, you know, Afrofuturist work from Brazil. We have an Afrofuturist Count of Monte Cristo book called The Last Count that's actually quite wonderful. So yeah, so that's what we've been doing on the comic side. And also created a brand new Afrofuturist character for Marvel called Ghostlight, actually. That was, again, using Sankofa to find a Black character that had been previously used in a comic like in the 1960s and then reintroducing him as a superhero. So
can I just add that for a lot of people, Afrofuturism is seen as a way forward because it's an inclusive look at futurism. If you look at, for example, Bitterroot, you've got not only are you looking at diverse people, but you're looking at people with different abilities. And, you know, most of the people that I know, I very seldom run into anyone who disagrees with the fact that, you know, from an Afrofuturist lens, we're not just looking at, you know, how Black people can thrive. We're not trying to create the Black planet that everybody fears. We're looking at a world where everyone can thrive.
Well, and to put a bow on that, Luana, can you just talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, Afrofuturism gives us a glimpse into all that we can be. But can you talk about how it meets the moment?
So, I mean, the best part is we are in this age of like AI and VR and, you know, people, everyone with social media, you combine all those things together. Everyone is in a space to be able to create content, media, messaging. And Afrofuturism creates a space where we can imagine all the things that are possible. And, you know, I encourage people when they're doing that to imagine, you know, the best possible things. But even when we look at it from a pessimist standpoint, being able to imagine those things helps us identify actions we can make to move in that direction. And also it helps people understand that, you know, there isn't like one way or one thing. And, you know, the word normal is probably my least favorite word in the dictionary because it implies that there is a norm in anything. And when you talk about human beings, the further we get away from expecting people to fit into a box, the closer we get to a society where everyone can thrive.
Well, Luana, this marks the 7th year of the Afrofuturism Lounge. What is it and why did you want to start it?
So, you know, it goes back to, you know, in 2018, we were talking about how the Black creators at Comic-Con are in the exhibit hall all day and they don't get to connect with each other. So in the initial conversations, it was really going to be a private party for creators. And I honestly can't remember whose idea it was, but the idea came up to open it up to the public because a lot of people in the public had never been exposed to many of the creators that were going to be in the room. And so that's how the first Afrofuturism Lounge was born, as a way to connect people who are working together and then to connect them with the public. We weren't really sure how many people were going to show up. I think we thought, Keith, maybe we thought like 50 people would show up or 100 people. 650 people registered that first year. What's really cool is Tim Fielder, who did Maddie's Rocket and Infinitum, and he's done a lot of journalism. He's been in a lot of exhibits. He just did something at the Met. You can hear his voice when you go to the Afrofuturism exhibit at the Smithsonian. So he's a graphic designer and illustrator. And, you know, one of Walter Greeson's books that I have in my library is Illmatic Consequences, where he looks at, like, Afrofuturism and hip-hop together. They got together and did a graphic history of hip-hop, which, you know, a graphic novel, of course, is fiction. A graphic history written by a historian is going to give you great images of historic people and places, and they're going to be the speakers that'll be talking at the Afrofuturism Lounge. We're also going to give people who attend the opportunity to vote on our People's Choice category for our $10,000 inclusive language art contest, where we're promoting non-biased communication. But most importantly, you know, as always, the Afrofuturism Lounge gives people who normally don't get to spend time together an opportunity to connect while they're in the same city.
That was my conversation with John Jennings, comics creator and UC Riverside professor Keithan Jones, founder of Kid Comics. Also, LaWanna Richmond, executive director and founder of Grioneers. And you know, some convention goers have been going to Comic-Con for years and traveling miles to do it, like Sheldon Thomas, who's been going since 2015. This year, he's excited for the Deadpool and Wolverine panel. For him, all the comic chaos is worth it.
As an introvert, all of these people is a little different for me. So, but it's fun, right? It's kind of fun. It's chaotic. You know, there's a lot of stress just kind of making sure you get to the things you really want to get to because there's so much stuff going on. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of fun.
Well, coming up, the legendary Bobby Rubio talks about his career and Filipino representation.
What made me turn was they asked me, how would your son feel if he looks on screen and the character, the little kid, doesn't represent him?
KPBS Midday Edition returns after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back. You're tuning in to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. You just got a quick preview of what's happening at Comic-Con. Animation is also getting its flowers at the convention, and many creators of that art actually start with a love for comics. That's the case for Bobby Rubio. Born and raised in San Diego, he has an animation career that spans nearly three decades. You got a favorite Disney or Pixar film? He probably worked on it. He most recently worked on Paramount's Transformers 1, which is having its big Hall H panel as we speak. Here's a clip from the trailer.
You have proven yourself worthy. Take these and access your full potential.
It's time to show them we are more than meets the eye.
All the hype sounds really exciting. Bobby joins me now to talk about the world of animation and what he's got lined up at the convention. Bobby, welcome.
Hi, Jade. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So what does it mean to be a storyboard artist?
Okay, a storyboard artist, it's very similar to a comic book artist. What we do is we get a script from the writer, and then we draw the images that is written on the script. So let's say if Optimus Prime is walking down this street with Megatron, it says it on that for the first panel. In the second panel, they see a dog running. Then those images need to be drawn. And so that would be the storyboard artist. I would draw exactly what the lines ask for. And then a progression of images of them walking down the street, them seeing a dog, that would then be taken to the editor and cut together into a sequence. Of course, the scene would be much longer than them meeting a dog, but that gives you a general idea of what a storyboard artist does.
Very cool. Well, like we mentioned, you've been in this business for nearly 30 years. I mean, you've worked on Treasure Planet, Up, Inside Out, Avatar, The Last Airbender, just to name a few. Out of all those projects, is there one that really stands out to you as being formative in your career?
It would have to be Float, the short film that I did, because I got to write and direct that. And it happens to be the very first Filipino-American lead characters for a short film for Disney and Pixar. And that was a tremendous honor to me. And the funny thing was, originally, I did not draw them as Filipino. I drew them as white characters, as Caucasian, because I wasn't too sure if Disney or Pixar or anybody really wanted to see this. Now, you got to understand, this was like almost 10 years ago when I started on it. And so we didn't have the representation that we do now. But what was amazing was Pixar had my back, and they were like, you know, this story is a story based off of you and your son. What made me turn was they asked me, how would your son feel if he looks on screen and the character, the little kid, doesn't represent him? And, you know, that hit me. I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to do this for my son. I'm going to do this for further generations. Let's do this. Let's make him Filipino. And so I was so thrilled that, you know, Pixar allowed me to do that. And so, you know, I feel that a little bit of the, you know, the glass ceiling is broken, just like maybe just a little crack, because there's still much to do. But at least, you know, we touched it and, you know, made a little crack.
Wow. Well, you mentioned that Float is based on your son, who is on the autism spectrum. Can you talk more about why it was important to represent and the inspiration behind it?
Yeah, my son, Alex, was diagnosed having autism when he was 2.5 years old. And, you know, it was very difficult for me, very, very difficult for me to process that. Because as a father and a new parent, you know, you have these visions of what your child would be. And nowhere was I thinking autism was in the cards. So I went into a depression. I just shut the world out. And my wife was like, you gotta get out of this funk. So she made me seek therapy. But also at the same time, she said, you know, you probably should tell your story. And so I did. I made a little funny thing as I made a comic book. I made a comic book cover, an image of this boy floating. It was called Alex, based off of my son. And I think a few years after that, I was looking at my son. He was getting much older. He was like 9 or 10. And I was like, you know, I really should tell this story because it's a good story. It's a story that must be told. And you know, if I put it off, I will never do it. So I started doing an animatic, which is I did a bunch of storyboards and then we cut it in editorial to see what it looked like. And I showed it to my friends and they were like, wow, this is amazing. You should show it to Lindsay. Lindsay Collins was the executive producer of the Spark Shirt program. And when I showed it to her, she's like, this is perfect for the program. And we'd like to give you an opportunity to write and direct your own short. And I took it. And I'm so grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah, that's excellent. I mean, what about animation makes it a really compelling medium for storytelling like that?
Well, especially for Float, you have a floating boy and it's much easier to do it in animation because, you know, you don't have to get a real boy and do effects and do a blue screen on him and like try to make him act. When you have animators, the top animators, especially at Pixar, they could be anything. They could be an ant, they could be a toy, and they could be a little boy. So animation allows you to the freedom to do any character. The effects of his hair flying up was also necessary in animation. The boy floating alone would definitely, you would have to use CGI effects anyways. There's no way you could do that in live action. So that's why you choose animation.
Right. Well, you're based in Oakland, but San Diego is your hometown. So what part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in Paradise Hills, that's southeast San Diego, and I went to Robert E. Lee Elementary. I believe it's Pacific Heights Elementary now, they changed it. And I went to Morris High School and Alexander Graham Bell Middle School.
Okay. All right. Did growing up in that area sort of help form your love for art?
Yes. You know, I was really into comic books and I was really into cartoons. And I don't know, Jade, if you talked to Keithan?
Yes, sure did.
Okay, then I don't know if Keithan told you the story, but both him and I grew up together. I was really into comic books. I really into cartoons. I was the best artist in elementary school. And when I went to middle school, my friends were like saying, hey, man, there's this kid who can draw just as good. He draws this awesome, like, robots and stuff and comics. I'm like, really? Really? And I couldn't believe it because I'd never seen that before. So we actually had an art battle. Like, his friends talked to my friends, and which all led up to us having a battle in the library. He was on one end with his friends. I was on the other end of the table with my friends, and we had pieces of paper. And then we would draw, like, okay, robots. Let's draw robots. And we drew robots. And then who had the better robot drawing? Let's draw superheroes. The better superhero drawing. And, you know, the funny thing and then the great thing is that rivalry that we had, you know, at the time, it was a rivalry. And I still liked him, and I had all kinds of respect for him. But, you know, when you're a rival, you're like, oh, there's Keithan. He's drawing good. So frustrating. But Keithan and I, man, we became friends. We were, like, really good friends. And, you know, I wish that to every artist. I didn't see it in the beginning, but, you know, you need that competition to up your game.
That's a whole link there, man. That's pretty cool. And it's interesting that you say that, because when you were talking about Float and being concerned about having Filipino characters in that, when I talked to Keithan along with a few others for an Afrofuturism panel, they also mentioned that same concern of being concerned about having Black characters in comics. So that's a pretty interesting connection, and also shows how important it is to have representation.
Right. When Keithan and I were both kids, I mean, our favorite comic book was the New Teen Titans, and there was a character named Cyborg, but there was only Cyborg. So there was no Filipino characters, but yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of representation, you're actually debuting your first independent comic this year, and it features a Filipino superhero. Well, what is it about, and what inspired you to write it?
The book I created is called Neighborhood Legend, and it's going to be on Kickstarter, and so people can sign up for that now. But it's about this kid that growing up in San Diego, and he inherits Eskrima sticks. Eskrima is our Filipino martial art. It's the stick fighting. You've seen it in movies. You've seen it in Dune. Black Widow has sticks. She fights Eskrima style. Daredevil. It's everywhere. It's prevalent in a bunch of movies. But you wouldn't know that it was a Filipino martial art form. And it's shocking and sad that people don't know that. And it's sad that I didn't find this out until I was much older. And so I took it upon myself to, like, create a superhero doing our Filipino martial art. But it's more than that. I definitely wanted it to have a San Diego flavor. He wants to be in university, but he can't afford it, so he works at a taco shop. I wanted a bunch of San Diego-ness to the book, because most comic books are set in the East Coast, like Spider-Man and most of Marvel Universe is in New York. So there's big giant buildings and skyscrapers and bridges of that sort. But then, you know, I wanted my book to reflect San Diego or the West Coast. So I wanted it to be more beaches and palm trees and taco shops and freeways and things of that nature. So it's another thing for, like, kids growing up here, San Diego kids. If they read the book, they'll be like, oh, I recognize this.
Right.
And this is cool. Cool that this superhero is running around a world that I recognize.
Right. Oh, that's great. Well, you're also on a few panels this year at Comic-Con, one of which will pay tribute to early Filipino comic creators. Why is it important to highlight those artists who came before?
Because the children who I hope come to the panel will get to know their history as well as, you know, me learning about mine. Although I am a bit familiar with the Filipino artists from the 70s. It was Tony DeZunga and Alex Nino that we are definitely focusing on. And I am familiar with their work. I didn't collect comics in the 70s. I started in the 80s. So they're a bit before me. But I saw how brilliant they were and how fast they were. And children need to know their history. And they need, you know, hopefully it'll give them some pride. And it'll also give them inspiration to think that they already are part of this, you know, this comic book world. So we've had trailblazers that came before us, and I myself am standing on their shoulders and everything that they've done before. So we're thanking them, and hopefully, you know, those names, Tony DeZunga and Alex Nino, will be remembered and continually remembered from here on out. And hopefully I get my stamp, and the next kid will be like, I remember Bobby Rubio.
That's what it's about. What else do you have in store for this convention?
I have a signing as well, but I'm also on Saturday night from 8 to midnight. I will be at the Gas Lamp Lumpia Factory, and that's free because, you know, it's not inside the Comic-Con. So for those of you who cannot go to the Comic-Con, you can meet up with me. It's a mixer from 8 to midnight. We're just hanging out. You know, you can come up and talk to me. We can take pictures. We could talk about the Padres and the Chargers and whatever you want. It's just nice to come back home and get to see friends and family again and get to geek out some comic book stuff while I'm here.
Oh, that's great. Well, enjoy yourself. I've been speaking with storyboard artist and comic creator Bobby Rubio. Bobby, so great to talk to you. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it was great talking to you too, Jade. Thank you for having me.
You know, young people are also enjoying their time at the Comic-Con. Madeline Custodio has been going since she was 2 years old. It's her 12th year now, so we asked her about her favorite Comic-Con memory.
Probably the ice cream truck last year with the new movie or series. That I don't know. It was a cool ice cream truck, though.
I'd remember the ice cream truck, too. Sometimes it is the little things. Well, that's our show for today. If you missed anything, you can download KPBS Midday Edition on all podcast apps. Don't forget to watch KPBS Evening Edition tonight at 5 for in-depth reporting on San Diego issues. The Roundtable is here tomorrow at noon. Before we go, though, I'd like to thank our Midday Edition team. Producers Ashley Rush, Juliana Domingo, and Jacob Ayer, with the help of Lainey Alfaro. Senior producer Brooke Ruth, art segment contributors Julia Dixon Evans and Beth Accomando, technical producers Ben Redlosk, Brandon Trufa, and Rebecca Chacone. The Midday Edition theme music is from San Diego's own Surefire Soul Ensemble. I'm Jade Hindman. Thanks for listening, and make it a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Maracal Design and Remodeling, helping homeowners with their home remodeling needs. From ADUs to custom kitchen remodels and room additions, Maracal Design and Remodeling designs and builds your dream home. Learn more at trustyourhometous.com.